The sweatshirt sat on a table in the arts and crafts building, sleeves spread wide. It was the same way my mother laid out clothes she wanted me to wear. The whole ensemble revealed, enticing me to put it on. Only this shirt was different. Rather than wear it, the police wanted me to identify it. "Do you recognize it?" asked a female state trooper with a warm smile and a matronly bosom. I stared at the sweatshirt, white with Princeton spelled across the front in proud tiger orange, and nodded. "It's Vivian's."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes." She had worn it to one of the campfires. I remembered because I had joked that it made her look like a marshmallow. She said it kept the mosquitoes away, fashion be damned. The trooper shot a glance at a colleague on the other side of the table. He nodded and quickly folded the sweatshirt. Latex gloves covered his hands. I had no idea why. "Did you take that out of Dogwood?" I said. The female trooper ignored the question. "Was Vivian wearing that sweatshirt when you saw her leave the cabin?"
"No."
"Give it some more thought. Take your time."
"I don't need more time. She wasn't wearing it."
If I seemed irritable, it was justified. The girls had been missing for more than a day, and everyone was running out of hope. I felt it all throughout camp. It was like a leak in a tub of water, the optimism draining away drop by precious drop. During that time, the arts and crafts building had been taken over by the police, who used it to organize search parties, sign in volunteers, and, in my case, informally interrogate 13-year-old girls. I had spent an hour there the night before, being grilled by a pair of detectives who took turns asking me questions. An exhausting back and forth, my neck sore from swiveling between them. I answered most of their questions, when the girls had left, what they were wearing, what Vivian said before departing the cabin. As for what I'd told her as she slipped outside, and how I prevented them from getting back in, well, that remained unspoken. The shame was too great, the guilt was even worse. Now I was being asked a new round of questions, although the female trooper displayed far more patience than the detectives. In fact, she looked like she wanted to hug me to her oversized chest and tell me that everything would be okay.
"I believe you," she said.
"Where did you find that sweatshirt?"
"I'm not at liberty to say."
I looked to the other side of the room, where the folded sweatshirt was being passed to yet another trooper. He also wore gloves. The skin of his hands shone white beneath the latex as he placed the sweatshirt into a cardboard evidence box. Dread flooded my heart. "Did any of the girls have secrets they might have shared with you, but not with others?" the trooper said.
"I don't know."
"But they did have secrets?"
"It's kind of hard to call something a secret if I don't know who else they told."
My teenage bitchiness was intentional, an attempt to wipe that pitying look off the trooper's face. I didn't deserve her pity. Instead, it only made her lean in closer, acting like the cool guidance counselor at school who was always telling us to think of her as a friend and not as an authority figure. "Most times teenage girls run away, they do so because they're meeting someone," she said. "A boyfriend, or a lover. It's usually someone others don't approve of. A forbidden romance. Did any of the girls mention anything like that?" I wasn't sure how much I should say, mostly because I didn't know what was going on.
"The girls ran away? Is that what you think?"
"We don't know, honey. Maybe. That's why we need your help, because sometimes girls run away to meet a boy who ends up hurting them. We don't want your friends to get hurt. We just want to find them. So if you know anything, anything at all, I'd really appreciate it if you told me."
I thought of the lovely bones, the teenager found dead in a field, the creepy neighbor who killed her.
"Vivian was seeing someone," I said.
The trooper's eyes momentarily brightened before she settled back down, forcing herself to keep playing it cool.
"Did she happen to tell you who it was?"
"Do you think he might have done something to her?"
"We won't know until we talk to him." I took that as a yes, which meant they thought Vivian, Natalie, and Allison were more than lost. They thought they were dead. Murdered. Just three sets of lovely bones on the forest floor.
Emma, the trooper said. If you know his name, you need to tell us.
I opened my mouth. My heart thundered so hard I felt it in my teeth.
It's Theo, I said. Theodore Harris White.
I didn't believe it, not even as I said it. Yet I wanted to. I wanted to think Theo had something to do with the girl's disappearance, that he was capable of hurting them. Because he already had hurt someone. Me. He shattered my heart without even realizing it. This was my chance to hurt him back.
Are you sure? The trooper said.
I tried to convince myself it wasn't bitter jealousy making me do this, that it made sense Theo would be involved. Once Vivian, Natalie, and Allison returned to the locked cabin, the first thing they would have done was find a counselor. They didn't because they had been out after hours, not to mention drinking. Both offenses would have gotten them kicked out of camp. So they had gone to the one person of authority they could trust, Theo. Now they were missing, likely presumed dead. That couldn't be a coincidence. At least that's the lie I told myself.
I'm certain, I said.
A few minutes later, I was allowed to return to Dogwood. The area outside the Arts and Crafts building hummed with activity as I left. There were cops and reporters and the bray of bloodhounds in the distance. Troopers had already started searching the camp pickup. I spotted them as I passed, peering into the open cab doors and rifling through the glove compartment. When I turned away, I saw a search party just returning from a trek through the woods. Most of them were townies, come to help any way they could. But I spotted a few familiar faces in the crowd. The kitchen worker who had piled my plate with pancakes on the 4th of July, which suddenly felt like weeks ago. The handyman who always seemed to be fixing something around camp. Then there was Theo, looking haggard in jeans and a t-shirt darkened by sweat. His hair was a shambles, a smudge of dirt stained his cheek. I flung myself toward him, not quite knowing what I intended to do until I was right there in front of him. I was both mad at Vivian and terrified for her, furious at Theo and in love with him. So my hands curled into fists. I pounded his chest. "Where are they?" I cried. "What did you do to them?" Theo didn't move, didn't flinch. Further proof in my confused mind that he had already steeled himself for a beating from my tiny hands. That deep down, he knew he deserved it.
29.
This isn't happening. I'm not going crazy. The words crash into my brain the moment I regain consciousness, making me sit up with a start. My head slams into something hard above me. Pain pulses along my hairline, joining another, previously unnoticed pain at the back of my head.
"Whoa," someone says. "Easy."
A moment of pure confusion passes before I realize where I am. Camp Nightingale. Dogwood. Ensconced in a bunk bed, the top of which I just introduced to my forehead. The person who spoke is Theo. He sits on my hickory trunk with Sasha's copy of National Geographic, passing the time until I wake up. I rub my head, my palm alternating between the two points of pain. The one in the front is already fading. The one in the back is the opposite. It grows in intensity.
"You took quite a tumble in the cellar," Theo says. "I broke some of your fall, but you still banged your head pretty bad."
I slide out of bed and stand, gripping Miranda's bunk in case I need support. My legs are rubbery, but strong enough to keep me upright. Small traces of the dark fuzziness that engulfed me in the lodge remain. I blink until they're gone.
"You need to rest," Theo says.
That's impossible at the moment. Not with him here. Not when my limbs tingle with anxiety, aching and restless. I look around the cabin and see everything is the same as it was this morning. Sasha's bed is still meticulously made. Crystal's teddy bear remains a lump beneath the blankets. They're still missing, aren't they? Theo confirms it with a solemn nod. My legs start to quiver, begging me to lie down again. I tighten my grip on the edge of Miranda's bunk and remain standing. Detective Flynn broke the news to their families. He asked if any of them have been contacted by one of the girls. No one has. Miranda's grandmother didn't even know she had a cell phone, so there's still no word on what carrier she uses.
Did Flynn talk to the kitchen staff?
He did. All of them live in the next town over. They're all cafeteria staff at the middle school there, just happy to have a job for the summer. They carpool together every morning before breakfast and every evening after dinner. No one stayed behind last night, and no one came in early this morning. Not even Marvin.
All that information I had given Flynn, all my attempts to help, ended up being for nothing. Disappointment swells in my chest, tight against my ribcage. Theo sets the magazine aside and says,
"Do you want to talk about what happened back at the lodge?"
"Not really."
"You said you saw Vivian."
My mouth goes dry, making it hard to speak. My tongue feels too sticky and heavy to form words. A bottle of water sits next to Theo. He gives it to me, and I swallow all but a few drops. "I did," I say after clearing my throat, "on the live feed of the cabin."
"I looked, Emma. No one was there."
"Oh, I know. It was..." I'm unable to adequately describe it. A hallucination? My imagination?
"Stress,"
Theo says.
"You're under a tremendous amount."
"But I've seen her before, when I was much younger. It's why I was sent away. I thought she was gone, but she's not. I keep seeing her, here, now." Theo cocks his head, looking at me the same way I'm sure he looks at his patients when he has to give them bad news.
"I had a conversation with my mother," he says. "We both agree it was wrong to invite you back here, even if it was with the best intentions. That doesn't mean we think any of this is your fault. It's ours. We underestimated the effect being here would have on you."
"Are you telling me to leave camp?"
"Yes," Theo says. "I think it's for the best."
"But what about the girls?"
"There's a search party looking for them right now. They've split into two groups. One is taking the woods to the right of camp, and another is doing the same thing on the left."
"I need to join it," I say, making a move toward the door on unsteady legs. "I want to help." Theo blocks my path.
"You're in no condition to go trampling through the woods."
"But I need to find them."
"They'll be found,"
Theo says as he grips my arms, holding me in place.
"I promise. The plan is to add more searchers tomorrow, if necessary. Within 24 hours, every square foot of this property will have been thoroughly searched."
I don't remind him that a similar search did little good 15 years ago. Every square foot of land was covered then, too. All it yielded was a sweatshirt. "I'm staying," I insist. "I'm not leaving until they're found." A rumble sounds in the distance, a deep thudding that echoes across the valley like thunder. A helicopter joining the search. The sound is familiar to me. I heard it a lot 15 years ago. The cabin rattles as the chopper roars overhead, low in the sky, practically skimming the trees. Theo grimaces as it passes.
"My mother doesn't trust you, Em,"
he says, raising his voice so we can compete with the helicopter.
"I'm not sure I do either."
I get louder, too. "I swear to you, I didn't hurt those girls."
"How can you be so sure? You were so messed up last night that I doubt you'd remember it if you did."
The helicopter retreats from the area, zooming out over the lake. Its departure leaves the cabin draped in silence. Lingering in the newfound quiet are Theo's words, and the accusation coiled within them.
What are you talking about?
Flynn talked to the other instructors, Theo says. All of them. Casey said she saw you by the latrine last night. She said you seemed drunk. When we talked to Becca, she admitted the two of you shared a bottle of whiskey while the rest of us were at the campfire.
I'm sorry, I say, my voice so incredibly meek I'm surprised Theo can even hear it.
So you were drinking last night?
I nod.
Jesus, Emma, one of the campers could have seen you.
I'm sorry, I say again. It was stupid and wrong and completely unlike me, but it doesn't mean I did something to those girls. You saw the camera footage. You saw I went looking for them.
Or followed them. There's no way of knowing with any certainty.
There is, I tell him, because you know me, and you know I wouldn't hurt those girls.
He has no good reason to believe me. Not after all the lies I've told. One word from Theo to the police could thrust me into the same situation I had put him in 15 years earlier. The fact that our roles are reversed isn't lost on me. I tilt my head and stare into his brown eyes, willing him to look back. I want him to see me, truly see me. If he does, maybe he'll recognize the girl I used to be. Not the damaged 28-year-old who was very likely losing her grip on sanity, but the 13-year-old who adored him.
Please believe me, I whisper.
A moment passes, a quivering period of time that lasts only a second but feels like minutes. During it, I can almost feel my fate hanging in the balance. Then Theo whispers back. I do. I nod, overwhelmingly grateful. I resist the urge to cry with relief. Then I kiss him. It's a surprise to both of us, just like the last time I kissed him, only more forceful. This time, it's not boldness that makes me do it, it's desperation. The girl's disappearance has me feeling so utterly helpless that I now crave the distraction I avoided the other day. I need something to momentarily take my mind off what's happening. I ache for it. Theo stays completely still, not reacting as I continue to press my lips to his. But soon he's kissing me back, upping the intensity. I press against him, my palms on his chest. Not hitting this time, caressing. Theo's arms snake around me, holding me tight, pulling me even closer. I know the deal. I'm as much a distraction for him as he is for me. I don't care. Not when his lips are on my neck and his hand is sliding under my shirt. More thudding sounds erupt from outside the window. Another helicopter approaching. Or maybe it's the same one, making another pass. It swoops directly over Dogwood. So loud I can't hear anything but the thrum of its rotors. The window rattles. Caught in that noise, Theo lifts me, carries me to my bunk, lowers me into it. He takes off his shirt, revealing more scars. A dozen, at least. They crisscross his skin from shoulder to navel, looking like claw marks. I think of his accident. Twisted metal, shattered glass, shards breaking skin and glancing off bone. I caused those scars. Every single one. Now Theo's on top of me, heavy and safe and warm. But I can't let this go any further. Distraction be damned. Theo, stop. He pulls away from me, confusion skidding through his eyes. What's wrong?
I can't do this.
I slide out from under him and move to the other side of the cabin, where I'm less likely to reach out and touch his scars, my fingers tracing the length of each one.
Not until I tell you something. Although the helicopter has moved on, I can still hear it thudding over the lake. I wait until the sound subsides before saying, I know, Theo, about you and Vivian.
There was no me and Vivian.
You don't need to lie about it, not anymore.
I'm not lying. What are you talking about?
I saw you, Theo. You and Vivian, in the shower. I saw, and it broke my heart.
When was this? Theo says.
The night they vanished. I don't need to say anything else. Theo understands the rest. Why I accused him, how that accusation has followed him since. He sits up and rubs his jaw, his fingers cutting through the salt and pepper stubble. I had always thought having the truth exposed would make me feel better. That relief would flood my body from my head to the tip of my toes. Instead, I only feel guilty, and petty, and unbearably sad. I'm so, so sorry, I say. I was young and stupid and worried about the girls and heartbroken because of you. So when that state trooper asked me if any of them had a boyfriend no one knew about, I told her that you were secretly seeing Vivian.
But I wasn't, he replies.
Theo, I saw you.
You saw someone, just not me. Yes, Vivian flirted and made it clear she'd be up for it, but I was never interested.
I replay that moment in my mind, hearing the moans muffled by the rush of the shower, peering through the space between the planks, seeing Vivian shoved against the wall, her hair running down her neck in wet tendrils, twisting like snakes, Theo behind her, pushing into her, face buried against her neck. His face. I never actually saw it. I had just assumed it was Theo because I had seen him in the shower before. It had to be you, I say. There's no one else it could be. You were the only man in the entire camp. Even as the words emerge, I know I'm wrong. There was someone else here, close to Theo's age. Someone who went unnoticed, simply doing his job, hiding in plain sight. The groundskeeper, I say.
Ben, Theo says with a huff of disgust. And if he did something like that back then, who knows what he's been up to now?
30. Tell me about the girls, Detective Flynn says. The ones who were missing. Did you have any interactions with them?
I might have seen them. Don't remember if I did or not, but probably.
Did you have any interactions with any of the girls in camp?
Not on purpose. Maybe if I needed to get somewhere and they were in my way, I'd say excuse me. Other than that, I keep to myself.
He looks up at us from a chair built for someone half his age, his gaze resting a moment on each of our faces. First me, then Theo, and finally Detective Flynn. We're all in the Arts and Crafts building, the mess hall having been taken over by the remaining campers and instructors for dinner. I spotted them glumly filing inside as Theo and I headed next door. A few of the girls still wept. Most wore stunned, blank expressions that were occasionally punctuated by disbelief. I saw it in their eyes when they lifted their faces to the sky as the search helicopter made another deafening pass over camp. So we ended up here, in a former horse stable, painted to resemble a storybook forest, lit by fluorescent bulbs that buzz overhead. I stand next to Theo, keeping several feet of space between us. I still don't entirely trust him. I'm sure he feels the same way about me. But for now, we're uncomfortable allies, united in our suspicion of a man whose full name I've only recently learned. Ben Schumacher. The groundskeeper. The man who had sex with Vivian. The same man who might know where Miranda,
Crystal and Sasha are. I let Flynn do the talking, choosing to stay silent, even though all I want is to pummel Ben Schumacher until he tells me where they are and what he's done to them. He certainly appears capable of doing harm. He's got a hard look about him. He spent much of his life working outdoors, and it shows in the calluses on his hands and the sunburned streak on the bridge of his nose. He's big, too. There's a noticeable bulk hidden beneath his flannel shirt and white tee.
"Where were you at 5 this morning?" Detective Flynn asks him. "Probably in the kitchen, about to get ready for work."
Flynn nods toward the gold wedding band on Ben's left hand.
"Can your wife confirm that?"
"I hope so, seeing how she was in the kitchen with me, although she's awfully groggy before that first cup of coffee."
Ben chuckles. The rest of us don't. He leans back in his chair and says,
"Why are you asking me this stuff?"
"What's your job here?" Flynn says, ignoring the question.
"Groundskeeper. I told you that already."
"I know, but what specifically do you do?"
"Whatever needs doing. Mowing the lawn, working on the buildings."
"So general maintenance?"
"Yeah."
Ben gives a half-smirk at the vaguely genteel job description.
"General maintenance."
"And how long have you worked for Camp Nightingale?"
"I don't. I work for the family. Sometimes that means doing some things for the camp, sometimes it doesn't."
"Then how long have you worked for the Harris Whites?"
"About 15 years.
"Which means the summer Camp Nightingale closed was your first summer here?"
"It was," Ben says.
Flynn makes a note of it in the same notebook he jotted down all my useless information.
"How did you get the job?"
"I was a year out of high school, picking up the odd job here and there around town, barely scraping by. So when I got wind that Mrs. Harris White was looking for a groundskeeper, I jumped at the chance. Been here ever since."
For confirmation, Flynn turns to Theo, who says,
"It's true." 15 years is a long time to be working the same job," Flynn tells Ben. "Do you like working for the Harris Whites?"
"It's decent work, pays well, puts a roof over my family's head and food in their stomachs. I got no complaints."
"What about the family? Do you like them?"
Ben looks to Theo, his expression unreadable.
"Like I said, no complaints."
"Back to your interactions with the girls in camp," Flynn says. "Are you certain there wasn't any contact with them? Maybe you had to do some work in their cabin."
"He installed the camera outside Dogwood," Theo says.
Flynn writes that down in his notebook.
"As you know, Mr. Schumacher, that's the cabin where the missing girls were staying. Did you happen to see them when you were putting up the camera?"
"No."
"What about the oldest one, Miranda? I've been told other camp workers noticed her."
"Not me," Ben says. "I keep my head down. None of this camp stuff is my business."
"What about 15 years ago? Were you the same way back then?"
"Yes."
Flynn makes a move to write down the answer in his notebook, but he pauses, his pen tip a millimeter from the page.
"I'm giving you another shot at the answer, just so I don't have to waste time writing down something that might be a lie."
"Why do you think I'm lying?"
"One of the girls who disappeared back then was named Vivian Hawthorne. You probably remember her."
"I remember that she was never found."
"I was told you might have had a relationship with Miss Hawthorne, which would be the complete opposite of minding your own business. So is it true? Was there a relationship between the two of you?"
I expect a denial. Ben gives us all a defiant look as that half-smirk lifts the corner of his lips. But then he says,
"Yeah, although it wasn't much of what you'd call a relationship."
"It was strictly sexual in nature," Flynn says.
"That's right, a one-and-done kind of deal."
Ben's smirk grows, on the verge of a leer. Again, I resist the urge to punch him, but I can't stop myself from saying, "She was only 16, you know that, right?"
"And I was only 19, Ben says. That age difference didn't seem like such a big deal. Besides, it wasn't illegal. I got 3 daughters of my own now, so I know damn well what the statutory rape laws are."
"But you knew it was a bad idea," Flynn tells him. "Otherwise, you would have told someone about it after Miss Hawthorne and 2 other girls from her cabin went missing."
"Because I knew the cops would think I had something to do with it. That's what this is about, right? You're all standing there thinking I had something to do with what happened to those poor girls. Did you?"
Ben stands suddenly, sending the chair skidding across the floor behind him. Veins bulge at his temples, and his hands curl into fists as though he's about to take a swing at Flynn. He definitely looks like he wants to.
"I'm a father now. I'd be going crazy if my girls were missing. Makes me sick to my stomach just thinking about it. You should be out there looking for them instead of asking me about some dumb shit I did 15 years ago."
He stops, out of breath. His chest heaves and his fists unclench. Resigned exhaustion settles over him as he retrieves his 2 small chair and sits back down.
"Keep on asking your goddamn questions," he says. "I'll answer them. I've got nothing to hide."
"Then let's go back to Vivian Hawthorne," Flynn says. "How did it start?"
"I don't know. It just kinda happened."
"Did you instigate it?"
"Hell no," Ben says. "Like I said, I wasn't looking for trouble. I mean, I saw her around camp. It was hard not to notice her."
"Did you find her attractive?" Flynn asks.
"Sure, she was hot, and she knew it. But there was something else about her. A confidence. It made her stand out from the other girls. She was different."
"Different how?"
"Most of those girls were stuck up, snooty. They'd look right past me like I wasn't even there. Like I didn't exist. Vivian wasn't like that. The very first day of camp, she came up to me and introduced herself. 'I don't remember you from last year.' That's what she said. She asked me about my job, how long I'd been here. Just friendly. It felt nice having someone like her pay attention to me."
That sounds like the Vivian I knew. A master at seduction. It didn't matter if you were the camp groundskeeper or a 13-year-old girl. She knew exactly what kind of attention you needed before you even knew it yourself.
"We hung out a few times those first days of camp. During lunch, she'd come find me working and talk for a few minutes. By then, I knew what she wanted. She wasn't shy about it."
Flynn, who's been steadily writing all this down in his notebook, pauses long enough to say,
"How many times did the two of you engage in intercourse?"
"Once."
"Do you remember the date?"
"Only because it was the 4th of July," Ben says. "I was working late that day, trying to milk the overtime money Mrs. Harris White was offering. All the girls were at the campfire, and I was getting ready to go home when Vivian showed up. She didn't say anything. She just came right up to me and kissed me. Then she walked away, looking over her shoulder to make sure I followed."
He gives no further details. Not that I need them. I already know the rest. What I don't know is why.
"That 4th of July was the night Miss Hawthorne and the others disappeared," Flynn says.
Ben nods.
"I know. I don't need a reminder." "What did you do after it was over?"
"Vivian left before me. I remember she was in a hurry to get out of there. She said people would start to realize she was gone. So she got dressed and left."
"And was that the last time you saw her?"
"Yes, sir, it was."
Ben pauses to scratch the back of his neck, giving the question more thought.
"Sort of." "So you did see her again after that?"
"Not her," Ben clarified. "Something she left behind."
"I don't follow,"
Flynn says, speaking for all of us.
I left the latrine not long after Vivian did. On the drive home, I realized my keys were missing, the ones I use for camp. What do they access? Camp buildings, Ben says. The lodge, mess hall, the tool shed, and latrine. The cabins? Flynn asks.
Ben offers us another partial smirk.
I bet you wish it was that easy, but no, not the cabins.
Flynn again looks to Theo for confirmation. He gives a slight nod and says,
"He's telling the truth." I thought they might have fallen out of my pocket in the latrine, Ben continues. Or maybe somewhere else. When I got to work the next morning, Vivian and the two others had already disappeared. At the time, no one seemed too worried. They'd only been gone a couple of hours, and everyone assumed they'd come back eventually. So I went looking for the keys. I ended up finding them at the tool shed behind the lodge. The door was open. The keys were still in the lock.
And you think Miss Hawthorne left them there?
I do. I think she took them out of my pocket when we were in the latrine.
What was kept in the tool shed? Flynn says.
Equipment, mostly. The lawnmower, chains for tires in winter, that kind of thing.
Why would she need to go to the tool shed?
The question elicits a shrug from Ben.
Damned if I know.
But I do. Vivian went there to retrieve a shovel. The same one she used to dig a hole that would eventually conceal her diary.
You should have told us, Theo says, about all of it. But you didn't, and now my family can never trust you again.
Ben gives him a hard stare. In his eyes burns what can only be described as barely concealed disgust.
Don't you dare judge me, Theodore!
He says, spitting out the name like something that's left a bad taste in his mouth.
You think you're better than me, just because some rich woman plucked you out of an orphanage? That just means you're lucky.
The color drains from Theo's face. I can't tell if it's because of shock or anger. He opens his mouth to reply, but is cut off by a noise rising suddenly from outside. Someone shouting. The voice echoes off the water.
I see something.
Theo turns to me, panicked.
That's Chet.
We rush out of the arts and crafts building, Detective Flynn in the lead, surprisingly quick on his feet. At the mess hall, a bunch of girls are pushing out of the door, clutching one another. Several of them cry out in distress, even though no one knows what's going on. No one but Chet, who stands at the lake's edge, pointing to something in the water. A canoe. Unmoored. Adrift. It bobs 100 yards from shore at a sideways angle, making it clear no one is guiding it. I race into the lake, marching high-kneed until the water reaches my thighs. I then fall forward, swimming now, taking quick, forceful strokes toward the errant canoe. Behind me, others do the same thing. Theo and Chet. Glimpses of them flash over my shoulder whenever I pause to take a breath. I'm first to the canoe, followed soon after by Chet, then Theo. We each grip the edge of the boat with one hand and start the swim ashore with the other. It's an awkward, labored trip. My wet fingers keep slipping from the canoe's edge, and our strokes are out of sync, making the boat jerk from side to side as we swim. Once in shallow water, the three of us stand and drag the canoe to shore. A crowd has gathered by then. Detective Flynn and Ben Schumacher, most of the campers kept at bay by counselors. At the lodge, Franny, Lottie, and Mindy watch from the back deck. I risk a glance inside the canoe, and my legs grow weak. The boat is empty. No oars, no life vests, certainly no people. The only thing inside is a pair of glasses, twisted like a wrung-out washcloth, one of the lenses spider-webbed with cracks. Flynn uses a handkerchief to lift it from the canoe.
Does anyone recognize these?
I stare at the red frames, somehow still standing, even though the sight of them should have sent me tumbling again into unconsciousness. I even manage to nod. Sasha, I say, my voice weak. They belong to Sasha. 31. Back in Dogwood, I lay in the bottom bunk, trying to keep it together. So far, I'm doing a shitty job. After the canoe was found, I went to the latrine and threw up. I then spent a half hour crying in the shower before changing into dry clothes. Now I hold Crystal's matted fur teddy bear as Detective Flynn graces me with another disbelieving stare.
"That's an interesting thing you did back there," he says, "swimming out to the canoe like that."
"You would have preferred I let it float away?" Flynn remains standing in the center of the room, some kind of power play, I assume, letting me know that he's fully in charge here.
"I would have preferred for you to leave it alone and let the police retrieve it. It's evidence. Now it's been tainted by 3 additional people."
"Sorry," I say, only because it's what he obviously wants to hear.
"Maybe you are, maybe you aren't. Or maybe you did it on purpose, covering up fingerprints or trace evidence you'd previously left behind."
Flynn pauses, waiting for I don't know what. A confession? A vehement denial? Instead, I say, "That's ridiculous."
"Is it? Then please explain this."
He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a clear plastic bag. Inside is a curl of silver chain on which hang 3 pewter birds. My charm bracelet.
"I know it's yours," Flynn says. 3 people confirmed they saw you wearing it.
"Where did you find it?"
"In the canoe."
I tighten my grip on Crystal's teddy bear to stave off a sudden onslaught of nausea. The cabin spins. I feel like I'm going to throw up again. I tell myself for the 50th time today that this isn't really happening. But it is. It has.
"Would you like to explain how it got there?" Flynn asks. "I know it wasn't on your wrist when you swam out to that canoe."
I lost it. Shock makes it a struggle to utter even the simplest words. Yesterday.
"Lost it," Flynn says. "That's convenient."
"The clasp broke." I pause, take a breath, try to think of a way to not sound insane. "I fixed it, with string, but it fell off at some point."
"You don't remember when?"
"I didn't notice. Not until later." I stop talking. Nothing I say will make sense to him. It certainly doesn't make sense to me. The bracelet was there until it wasn't. I don't know when or where it went from being on my wrist to being lost.
"So how do you think it got into the canoe?" Flynn says.
"Maybe one of the girls found it and picked it up, intending to return it to me later." It's a stretch. Even I can see that. But it's the most logical chain of events. Miranda saw me twisting the bracelet during yesterday's painting lesson. I can easily picture her spotting it on the ground, scooping it up, dropping it into her pocket. The only other possible explanation is that it was found by the same person responsible for the girl's disappearance. What if I'm being framed? It's less a fully formed thought than a desperate attempt to get Flynn on my side, yet the more I think about it, the more it starts to make sense. That bracelet fell off yesterday, before the girls vanished, and now it's in the same canoe as Sasha's broken glasses. Talk about convenient. What if whoever took the girls put it there on purpose to make me look guilty?
"I think you're doing a pretty good job of that all by yourself."
"I didn't touch those girls. How many times do I have to say it before you believe me?"
"I'd love to believe you," Detective Flynn says. "But it turns out you're a difficult woman to believe, Miss Davis. Not with all that talk about seeing people who weren't really there, or your conspiracy theories. This morning you told me Francesca Harris-White had something to do with it, but less than an hour ago you were certain it was the groundskeeper."
"Maybe it was."
Flynn shakes his head.
We talked to his wife. She confirmed he was in the kitchen at 5 a.m., right where he said he was. And then there's all those things you said 15 years ago about Theo Harris White. Didn't you accuse him of hurting your friends back then?
A sharp heat burns my cheeks. Yes, I say.
I'm assuming you don't believe it now.
I look at the floor. No.
It would be interesting to know when you stopped believing he was guilty and started thinking he was innocent, Flynn says. Because you never retracted that accusation. Officially, Mr. Harris White is still a suspect in that disappearance. I guess you two now have something in common.
My face gets hotter with anger. Some of it's directed at Detective Flynn. The rest is reserved for me and how horribly I acted back then. Either way, I know I can't listen to Flynn rehash my bad behavior for a minute longer.
Are you going to charge me with something?
Not yet, Flynn replies. The girls haven't been found, dead or alive, and a bracelet isn't enough to charge you. At least not unless a lab analysis finds some of their DNA on it.
Then get the hell out of this cabin until you do. I don't regret saying it, even though I know it makes me look even guiltier. It occurs to me that some cops would even take it as an admission of guilt. Flynn, however, merely raises his hands in a don't-blame-me gesture and moves to the door.
We're done for now, he says. But I'll be watching you, Miss Davis.
He won't be the only one. Between the camera outside the cabin and Vivian at my window, I've gotten used to being watched. When Detective Flynn leaves, his exit lets in the sound of police boats out on the lake. They arrived shortly after the discovery of the canoe. Meanwhile, the helicopter is still going, rattling the cabin with each pass. I can't remember if the helicopter 15 years ago showed up the first day or the second. The boats and volunteer search party were the first. That I definitely remember. All those people wearing flimsy orange vests and grim expressions as they marched into the woods. All those boats crisscrossing the lake, giving up once Vivian's sweatshirt was found in the forest. That's when the dogs were brought in, on the second day. Each allowed to sniff a piece of clothing plucked from the girls' trunks to absorb their scents. By then, Franny had already decided to close the camp, so as the dogs were barking their way around the lake, hysterical campers were hustled onto buses or pulled into SUVs with dazed parents behind the wheels. I wasn't so lucky. I had to spend another day here, for investigative purposes, I was told. Another 24 hours spent huddled in this very bunk, feeling pretty much the same way I do now. The helicopter has just passed once again when I hear a knock on the cabin door. Come in, I say, too spent with worry to open it myself. A second later, Becca pokes her head into the cabin. A surprise, considering the tone of last night's conversation. At first, I think she's here to offer condolences. I turn away when she enters, just so I can avoid the half-pity, half-sorry look I'm certain she'll give me. My gaze drifts instead to the camera in her hands. If you're here to take more pictures, you can leave right now, I say.
Listen, I know you're pissed I told that cop we got drunk last night. I'm sorry. I got freaked out by the whole situation and told the truth, not thinking it would make you look suspicious. If it's any consolation, it makes me look suspicious, too.
As far as I know, all the girls in your cabin are present and accounted for.
I'm trying to help you, Emma.
I don't need your help.
I think you do, Becca says.
You should hear what they're saying about you out there. Everyone thinks you did it, that you snapped and made those girls disappear the same way Viv, Natalie, and Allison vanished.
Even you?
Becca gives me a pointed nod.
Even me. No use lying at this point, right? But then I started examining some of the photos I took around camp this morning.
looking to see if I accidentally captured any clues about what might have happened.
I don't need you playing detective for me, I say.
It's better than the job you've been doing, she remarks. Which, by the way, everyone also knows about. You haven't exactly been subtle with your sneaking around camp and asking questions. Casey even told me she saw you slip into the lodge yesterday.
Of course, Camp Nightingale is just as gossipy now as it was 15 years ago.
Maybe even more so. God knows what the counselors and campers have been saying about me. Probably that I'm obsessive and crazy and make bad choices. Guilty as charged.
I wasn't sneaking, I say, and I'm assuming you found something interesting or you wouldn't be here.
Becca sits on the floor next to my bunk and holds up the camera so I can see it. On the display screen is an image of me standing dumbly in Lake Midnight and Franny waiting in after me. Once again, I'm reminded of how great a photographer Becca is. She captured the moment in all its awful clarity, right down to the water seeping into the hem of Franny's nightgown. Theo's in the middle of the photo, standing in his boxers between the lake and the lodge. The pale patchwork of scars on his chest pop in the morning light, visible to all. Yet I had missed them completely. I had other things on my mind. Beyond Theo is the lodge itself, its back deck occupied by Chet and Mindy. He's in track shorts and a t-shirt. She's in a surprisingly sensible cotton nightgown.
Now here's one from the reverse angle, Becca says.
The next photo shows the full crowd of campers drawn to the water's edge by my screams. The girls clutch one another, fear still etching itself onto their sleep-pinkened faces.
I counted them, Becca says. 75 campers, counselors, and instructors, out of a potential 80.
I do the math. 3 of the 5 people absent from the photo are Sasha, Miranda, and Crystal, for obvious reasons. I'm another, because at that moment I was being led by Franny from the chilly water of Lake Midnight. The 5th missing person is Becca, the person taking the photo.
I'm not sure what you're getting at.
Only 1 person in the entire camp didn't come to see what was going on, Becca replies. Don't you think that's strange?
I snatch the camera from her hands and bring the display screen closer to my face, trying to identify who might be missing. I recognize nearly all the girls, either from the painting lessons or just roaming around camp. I spot Roberta and Paige caught in the middle of exchanging worried looks. I see Kim, Danica, and the other 3 counselors. Each of them huddle with the girls from their respective cabins. Behind them is Casey, identifiable by her red hair. I click to the previous photo, seeing me and Franny in the lake, Theo on the grass, Chet and Mindy up at the lodge. The only person missing is Lottie.
Now you see it, Becca says.
Are you sure she's not there? I scan the photo again, looking in vain for any sign of Lottie behind Chet and Mindy. There isn't one.
Positive. Which begs this question. Why?
Nothing I can think of makes sense. My screams were loud enough to bring the entire camp to the lakeshore, which makes it impossible for Lottie not to have heard them. Yes, there's a chance her absence is completely innocuous. Maybe she's a heavy sleeper, or she was in the shower. It's spray drowning out the sound of my screams. But then I think about my bracelet. It feels like it's still wrapped around my left wrist. A phantom sensation. The last time I remember being aware of its presence was when I was in the lodge, searching the study. With Lottie. Maybe it fell off. Or maybe she took it while I was engrossed by all those old photographs of Camp Nightingale. I consider Vivian's diary, which by this point has become a kind of Rosetta Stone for trying to decipher what was happening 15 years ago. Vivian mentioned Lottie, but only in passing. Just that one sentence about how Lottie caught her in the lodge study and then told Franny about it.
I didn't give it much attention, mostly because I had Franny's dirty little secret distracting me. But now I wonder if that brief mention has greater meaning, especially in light of my own encounter with Lottie in the study. She spoke at length about her family's decades of service with the Harris White clan. That suggests an unusual amount of devotion passed down through generations. Just how devoted of an employee could Lottie be? Enough to take action if she knew Vivian was close to learning what Franny's dark secret could be? Then do it again after realizing I'm on the verge of doing the same thing, only this time as some twisted kind of warning? Maybe, I say. Lottie wasn't there because she already knew what was happening. 15 years ago. After lashing out at Theo, I spent the rest of the day weeping in my bottom bunk. I cried so hard that by the time night fell, my pillow was soaked with tears. The pillowcase, salty and damp, stuck to my cheek when I looked up as the cabin door opened. It was Lottie, solemnly bearing a tray of food from the mess hall. Pizza, side salad, bottle of Snapple. "You need to eat something, honey," she said. "I'm not hungry," I told her, when in truth I was famished. Pain gnawed at my gut, reminding me that I'd barely eaten since the girls left the cabin. "Starving yourself won't help anyone," Lottie said as she placed the tray on my hickory trunk. "You need a good meal to be ready for when your friends return." "Do you really think they're coming back?" "Of course they will." "Then I won't eat until they do." Lottie gave me a patient smile. "I'll leave the tray here in case you change your mind." Once she was gone, I approached the tray, sniffing at the food like a feral cat. Ignoring the salad, I went straight for the pizza. I managed 2 bites before the pain in my gut worsened. It was sharper than hunger, shooting from my stomach into my heart. Guilt. That I'd said that horrible thing to Vivian right before she left. That I'd locked the door before they returned. That all day I told myself I simply provided an answer to that state trooper's innocent question, but deep down I knew the score. By saying Theo's name, I had accused him of harming Vivian, Natalie, and Allison. All because he picked Vivian over me. Not that such an outcome had ever really been in doubt. I was a scrawny, flat-chested nothing. Of course Theo chose her. And now I assumed he and everyone else in camp hated me. I couldn't blame them. I hated myself more. Which is why I was surprised when Franny came to Dogwood later in the night. She had spent the previous night there. Not wanting me to be alone, she crept in with a sleeping bag, some snacks, and a pile of board games. When it was time to sleep, Franny unrolled the sleeping bag on the floor next to my bunk. That's where she slept, lulling me to sleep by singing Beatles songs in a soft, gentle voice. Now she was back, the bag of snacks and games in one hand and her rolled-up sleeping bag in the other. "I just got off the phone with your parents," she announced. "They'll be here tomorrow morning to take you home. So let's make your last night here a restful one." I stared at her from my tear-stained pillow, confused. "You're staying here tonight, too?" "Of course, my dear. It's not good to be here all by yourself." She dropped the sleeping bag onto the floor and began to unroll it. "You don't have to sleep on the floor again." "Oh, but I do," Franny said. "We must keep the beds free for when your friends return any minute now." I imagined Vivian, Natalie, and Allison flinging open the door and tramping inside, dirty and exhausted, but very much alive. "We got lost," Vivian would say. "Because Allison here doesn't know how to read a compass." It was such a comforting thought that I glanced at the door, expecting them to do just that. When they didn't, I started to cry again, adding a few more drops to the pillowcase. "Hush now," Franny said, swooping to my side. No more tears for today, Emma.
They've been gone so long.